Welcome to the Nerd Party.
Let the filibustering begin.
Welcome to Nerd Party.
Hello and welcome to Filibuster here on the Nerd Party Network. I'm Dallas King, your co-host, and with me as always is Lee Hutcherson. How are you?
Yeah, I'm really good, thanks. I think I'd be the Everett Ross in this situation. So
if you're Everett Ross, then I'm worried as who that is.
I think that makes you maybe Julie Louis-Dreyfus, one of the richest, best comedians of our time.
Julie Louis-Dreyfus in this scenario. Someone who, unless you've seen the TV series, you've got really no idea what she's doing in there, apart from, hey, it's that woman from Seinfeld and Veep. Nervously laughing. What the? But, yeah, if you've guessed right, today's big film to be talked about is Black Panther Wakanda Forever, written and directed by Ryan Coogler, starring Letitia Wright, Lupita Nyong'o, Dana Gurey, Winston Duke, Angela Bassett, and introducing Tenoch Huerta and Martin Freeman. Yes, Martin Freeman is back as the token white guy of the Black Panther franchise, which sees Queen Ramonda, Shuri, M'Baku, Okoye, and the Dora Milaje fight to protect the Kingdom of Wakanda from intervening world powers in the wake of King T'Challa's death, including Namor, the winged serpent god of underwater nation Talokan. So I think we should probably start with the big thing regarding Black Panther Wakanda Forever, and that is the absence of King T'Challa due to the passing of star Chadwick Boseman a couple of years ago due to colon cancer. Obviously, there is a huge shadow been left over the production and indeed the finished film. Obviously, this was probably not the original story they were looking to tell, but I guess credit to Marvel and Ryan Coogler in some ways, and that they said, you know, it was too soon to be talking about recasting the character. And I will admit that in the first scene where we're introduced to Shuri trying to recreate the heart-shaped herb in order to try and save her brother, who is off-screen at the time, I was worried that we were going to see, given the Star Wars franchise's predilection to, and even actually Ghostbusters Afterlife, some dodgy CGI version of characters, I'm glad to see that they didn't go down that route and kept the character of T'Challa off-screen. I mean, what were your thoughts going into Black Panther Wakanda Forever and sort of given this situation? How do you feel that his passing was handled by the film?
It's one of those ones. I think I caught it on Saturday, and you know, I think I didn't really read any of the reviews, but I could sort of see some of the online chatter, and it was kind of like, you know, that the film's very respectful, that it had this really powerful opening and closing scene, and I thought that sounds about kind of probably what they're going to be doing with this sort of the acknowledgement of this kind of passing and how they would handle it. And personally, I kind of thought this introduction scene of, like, you know, he's dying off camera in another room, you know, that she's trying to make this herb to sort of cure him, and it all kind of happens very, very quickly, and you're kind of like, oh, it feels obvious that they didn't have the actor available and that they sort of wanted to acknowledge it in some way, that I just kind of felt like it was an unnecessary kind of scene. And that perhaps they should have sort of just gone with the approach of, oh, well, why don't we maybe sort of, just sort of begin the film acknowledging that he has died, as opposed to sort of giving us this scene where it's kind of good, no, well, sort of neither acknowledging that he's dead or that we're off to kill him, but we're off to kill him kind of off screen. It just felt like pretty badly done, in my opinion.
I mean, I will give them the sort of fact that they are trying to set up like an arc for Shuri, in sort of she's feeling a bit of guilt over the fact that, you know, she was trying to use, you know, what her, not superpower, but her skills and talents are in the world of science and stuff, in order to try and save her brother, and the fact that she's too late in being able to do that, she carries that guilt around, and it sort of feeds her arc in further in the film. I mean, I'm sort of glad in some ways that, you know, it was sort of it's sort of, it's remarked on, it's sort of, they have the sort of funeral scene and then they sort of move on. I mean, I'm glad they didn't sort of get into any sort of discussion about, you know, it was just like, he was ill, he was suffering from an illness, he passed on. You know, there wasn't any sort of big debate about what the illness was. You know, was it potentially caused by the snap and the blip or anything like that? It was just, he's dead, let's move on. I mean, my issue with the regrowing of the heart-shaped herb is that essentially they were forced to backtrack over one of the plot points in the first film, which is that Killmonger destroys all of this herb, which gives the Black Panther's powers, so no one else could be Black Panther, and therefore it sets up this potentially slightly unnecessary subplot in the new film where they're having to do that. But I mean, I thought the funeral sort of sequence is incredibly powerful, but you know, you go online later on and then someone, you know, inevitably is mourning about the fact, which is the common problem in all Marvel movies these days, is that where were the Avengers? Why were the Avengers not invited to the funeral and stuff like that? And there's actually, you know, several characters who appear later on in the film are asked point blank, why were you not at the funeral? And then they have to explain, but you know, why wasn't Bucky Barnes at the funeral? You know, why was all these people? And it's just like, it's unnecessary. You know, it's, you know, Wakanda has always been pretty much this isolated nation, you know, so they would probably have kept things very, you know, small and internal. But, you know, so we move on. So the passing is death. It cuts to 1 year later. Wakanda is now essentially under threat. Their protector has gone, and now other nations believe it's basically just like open season on Wakanda, known for their ability to produce this vibranium, which they want to use as weapons. And so, you know, facilities of theirs are attacked. There's a fantastic sequence, probably one of the better sequences in the film, by, for me, the MVP of the film, Angela Bassett. I thought she was fantastic as Queen Ramonda, where she sort of basically scolds the United Nations for trying to move in and attack them in a way, and sort of frog marches the captured Navy SEALs and stuff into the UN offices and stuff like that. I thought that was a really sort of strong start. And then we get the introduction of the, again, not villains, probably, I would say the antagonist. I mean, I don't know, in terms of trailers for the film, did you have that awkward situation where you were watching a trailer for the new film that features lots of blue people fighting in water, to then go straight into a new film that features blue people fighting in water?
I did indeed, and it was one of those ones. It made Eve, like, I'm not particularly excited for Avatar 2, but it kind of was one of those ones watching it going, wow, look at this presentation. Bright colors, I can see this amazing underwater world. Wow, they've really spent their time developing this world and making it feel real, colorful, and engaging. And then sort of going into this film where I'm like, you know, it's something that, you know, you're more used to saying about sort of the DCEU of like, I can't make anything out, what's going on here, to having to watch that entire film and like being, if someone asked me, so what did you make of this underwater world, I was like, I can't really remember. There was this sort of waiting room and there was like this sort of gold temple, but, you know, barely being able to make anything out between underneath what would have probably been incredibly detailed work that just didn't show it whatsoever. It felt pretty bad. And I think there was even a line where, I can't remember exactly, but someone was like, are these blue people from under, like, what's it with these blue people? And it just felt like so on the kind of nose of like, yep, we're getting a very similar Disney movie soon enough, which I already suspect will be a million times better.
Yeah, I thought the irony was that, you know, they're not blue until they actually step out of the water. Obviously something to do with the oxygen levels and whatever turns the skin blue when they're out. So I was wondering if they maybe could have, maybe it was too late. I guess the Avatar trailer, teaser trailer dropped too late for them to go back and course correct and just apply a different shade perhaps to the people once they came out. But I will agree with you on the darkness and the murkiness of it. There was one particular scene where this wasn't even like the 3D screening, which I imagine would have been even worse, but I was struggling to really see what was going on. And it's been commented on actually quite a lot on social media, as people wondering if there was an issue with the DCP, if it was the cinema's projection levels, if they were like the lumens on the bulbs were being, you know, reduced on purpose in order to save money and stuff like that. Because the scene where Namor first arrives in Wakanda and comes out of the sea, and it's at night, and, you know, yes, I mean, somebody basically tried to justify it with, well, it was night, it would be dark, or it's underwater, things would be dark underwater. And it's like, well, no, not always. You know, you would, you know, you're trying to present something, you would present it in a way that people are still able to see what's going on. You don't it wouldn't be completely natural. Also, you'd have moonlight and there was a fire and stuff like that. I mean, that scene, could you tell what was going on? I mean, it took me about probably 10, 15 seconds to notice he'd actually come out of the sea.
No, I struggled with it quite a bit. I found, you know, it's one of these ones where you watch and, you know, I was almost thinking of Moonlight, which is feels like a very unfair comparison to draw with Wakanda Forever. And, you know, yeah, my comment is a little bit on the nose, but I was thinking of I read an interview, I think it was with Barry Jenkins, and I don't know the cinematographer of Moonlight off the top of my head, but it was the idea that it's so, that he was like, cinematography and lighting for black people is really often badly done in films, and, you know, there are ways to do it, and Moonlight highlighted that, you know, with the amount of scenes that take place near the sea, on beaches and so on. And I was sort of thinking about that, where I was like, you know, that was a stunning film where they used, you know, the light of the moon, you know, kind of, there's a, and obviously in this case, there was a fire. I can't remember if there was a beachside fire. And it was so well lit. It felt emotional. It felt powerful. And I was watching this going, you know, they're in some sort of like, you know, equivalent of a sort of African kind of safari where, you know, you've got some elephants nearby, you've got the kind of sea, you've got a fire. And I was just like, I can't make out what anything's going on here. And I was like, and in a film that cost 1/250th of a Wakanda Forever, was like, here's how you do proper cinematography, here's how you light characters, here's how you light black characters and make it clear to the audience, make it engaging. And this film, it felt so incompetently done on all levels with darkness. And, you know, I was thinking the same. I was like, I bet someone would pull up going, well, they are underwater, what can they do? I was like, well, you just put a line, oh, like, you know, we're under the sea, but, you know, we've got these, maybe there's creatures or something like that that kind of light things up a little bit. You know, there's a lot of things we take a huge leap of faith with when it comes to these sorts of comic book movies. So I thought it was just so badly done that I just thought it was incredibly amateurish, and, you know, there's better films out there that are doing it.
Yeah, James Laxton is the cinematographer for Moonlight, which I believe the original playbook was called, was it Black People Look Blue in the Moonlight or something? So yeah, this one is cinematographer's Autumn Durald Archipel, and she was the director of photography on Loki and Mainstream, you know, a film which I'm still a big fan. But, you know, I think, again, part of the issue is, you know, they probably were not really on a safari and stuff like that. And you've got this, you know, when you're in something like The Volume or a soundstage or something like that, it's always going to be difficult. But, you know, there are ways to get lighting shot correctly, or even be able to auto-adjust it afterwards. So yeah, no, there were a few scenes where it was incredibly difficult to see, and it just sort of always sort of distracts you, it sort of takes you out of the moment, which is a shame. But sort of coming back to Namor, who is I guess we could have a debate here about whether or not you feel he is a villain or an antagonist, perhaps, because, you know, he's another one of Marvel's, you know, antagonists who you can completely see his point of view. Obviously, you know, Killmonger had, you know, strong issues about what the role of Wakanda in the world, and he does as well. He obviously wants Wakanda to partner with Talokan to protect, you know, both of their nations against, you know, the rest of the world. You know, it's like, I think I saw someone sort of going, it was almost like the Mitchell and Webb sketch, sort of like, come with the Nazis, and this, we've got skulls on our hats, are we the bad guys? And it's like, you know, is the bad guy in the film is essentially the American government looking to plunder the smaller nation in terms for its resources and stuff like that, and the only thing apparently stopping them was the fact that they had a superhero to protect them. So, I mean, where did you sort of stand on Namor as, I guess, as a character and as the antagonist of someone who initially wants to partner with them, but very quickly is switches to, well, if you're not going to help, I will destroy you as well.
Yeah, I didn't really buy into that. I felt like the obvious threat in, you know, to both of them was the Americans, you know, or European powers, or should I just say the kind of the United Nations, which was, that's an interesting concept. Like
France came in for a bit of a kicking in this film for some particular reason. France were singled out, which was...
Yeah, I mean, you know, underrated colonizers, you know, when we think of, you know, the Brits, the Americans, you know, the French have just been as bad. But it felt like at the beginning of that film where... you have this sort of French, you know, tactical team kind of come in, you know, they're looking to steal the vibranium. You're like, okay, so there's going to be about like international conflict. They've come out into the world. This is where the problem is. And then you sort of have, I'm going to just call it kind of, I can't remember the name of the underwater world off the top of my head, but you know, you have Telegram. So you have it where they're like, okay, so they're going to be like the threats to each other. And it just felt like it was sort of like a, you know, I guess that could be a point to an extent that, you know, it's about these two people that have more in common than not sort of being kind of driven into conflict. Well, perhaps some of the you know, the bigger historical dogs kind of, you know, sort of stay on the sidelines and let people kind of fight it out. But it just sort of felt like such a kind of, I just didn't really buy into the conflict, whether that was by default or by design, which sort of just undercut the whole thing. It felt like there was another enemy in sight. And, you know, that would have made for a much more interesting kind of global conflict style thing. And, you know, the idea that I was almost thinking in my head was almost like, is there some sort of like weird Cold War that develops between sort of like the United Nations and sort of like Wakanda over sort of like vibranium and sort of like almost a kind of like a spy thriller, you know, maybe that what that 5 minutes at the beginning about sort of the invasion force is like that, like a kind of really small scale, and I'll kind of explain into later why I feel like that would have been a better approach, but like a small scale sort of like spy international espionage, maybe something similar to that kind of Jack Ryan about people trying to infiltrate Wakanda, you know, sort of maybe kind of building up a sort of tension, you know, maybe like a hostage style situation, just something that kind of escalates and sort of forces kind of Shuri, the Queen, and those characters to kind of handle what's like to kind of go into the world. Whereas just sort of this ultimate kind of big battle off between Wakanda and sort of the blue people just didn't really work. You know, they're both victims of colonization. They've both been driven underground or into isolation. And it felt like a little bit of a repeat of what we saw in sort of the previous kind of movie. And, you know, I remember sort of very much empathizing with sort of Killmonger's kind of approach in this one, whereas this one just felt like, really, really kind of frustrating.
Yeah, no, I mean, I had... quite a few issues with this particular sort of the plot that it goes down. Obviously, you know, you've got, you know, for cinematically, it was like, oh, a battle between Wakandans and the sort of Talakan with Namor, who described himself as a mutant. Again, I'm slightly doubtful on is he a mutant? Or, you know, because, you know, he had something like, it was directly, basically, you know, his mother took something, and then that sort of evolved. You know, is that natural? Sort of the natural mutant evolution, as of, but again, they might be sort of retconning how what the defines a mutant, I guess, in order to do that. But he's got little, you know, winged feet, so you know, there's that something. But for me, it's like it just felt like the entire thing could have been, if they just sat down and talked a bit more. They could have avoided this entire conflict. I mean, at one point, the character Riri Williams, who seems to be a young substitute for like Tony Stark at the moment, she actually plays sort of Ironheart in the comics and stuff like that. She basically sort of says, you know, don't take that dress. You know, I've seen, you know, Princess Leia and Return of the Jedi and Raiders of the Lost Ark and stuff and Belle and Beauty and the Beast. You know, it's basically, you know, he's going to try and marry you and and you're going to become sort of reunite the nations and stuff like that. You know, perhaps, you know, that if it had gone down that route, that might have been slightly more interesting. But I think it's, yeah, it just felt that it was forced. And it took like the sacrificing another major character in order to push them towards this major conflict, whereas I guess I think what you were saying about, you know, this external force which could have been put pressure on and allowed them to team up, maybe that will come down the line. But for me, sort of talking about it now, it feels like perfect antagonist and villain in this would have been, I guess, like a full-blown arc for Julia Louis-Dreyfus, Allegra DeFontaine, who apparently was married to Tim from The Office. But, you know, I guess the problem is that she's only been in the TV shows very, very, very briefly at the moment.
Well, she was in Black Widow, wasn't she?
The post-credit of Black Widow, no, that was it, yes. And I was thinking it was... she was in that. And then Florence Pugh's character then turns up. And I thought it was just... I'd forgotten it was just... the Hawkeye TV series, but no, that fed into the Hawkeye TV series. And then she was at the end of the Falcon and the Winter Soldier as well. But she's obviously the person who's kind of is pushing towards this the Thunderbolts TV series, where the sort of the anti-hero sort of ones, like the US Agent, and you've got Yelena, and even like Abomination and stuff like that. A group of them being sort of tasked with going in and getting the vibranium and stuff like that potentially would have been, that would have been a lot of characters to have to deal with. But they would have, I guess, felt like a more suitable choice for a villainous role in this. But I guess it's too soon to, they're still working out all the parts of how that's coming together. So I guess it's just a slightly awkward time room. But again, you know, the story of Wakanda Forever was probably not the one that they originally planned to tell. So things obviously sort of have to change. But I mean, what did you make of Tenoch Huerta's performance of Namor? I mean, I particularly kind of liked, I mean, it's always difficult when you've got this new character who has to basically tell his entire backstory via flashback and stuff like that. But I did particularly like the... how he came about his name in this particular iteration of the character. I thought that was quite cleverly done.
Yeah, I thought he was a fine enough villain, you know, probably in the better tier of our Marvel villains, but that is pretty, pretty thin. I just sort of felt, you know, the kind of... There was just too much sort of a bit of similarities with, you know, the classic sort of Killmonger thing of, like, you know, someone else that's sort of looking to strike back against sort of former oppressors and things like that. And, you know, sort of taking, you know, frustrations out on sort of Wakanda and sort of how they've taken an approach to international politics and so on. I just thought it was a little bit too kind of similar. And, you know, there was a great bit where one of the characters, I think it was M'Baku, where he was kind of like, you know, this guy's like a god, you know, like you strike him down, you're going to make all these people kind of more kind of you know, they'll want to come after us. They want to blame us.
You don't want to turn them into a martyr and then risk open war against them.
Yeah, but you never kind of got that impression from, because I suppose we spent so little time in that world. You know, we saw why he would be a godlike figure, but we didn't necessarily see why he would sort of like stir up those feelings or see him perhaps carrying out sort of godlike things. You know, obviously there was that little bit of a small relationship with someone during a breakout scene, but nothing much where you're like, oh, wow, what a powerful kind of character.
Yeah, I mean, for me, I would have potentially been jealous of this guy and the fact that, you know, he gets to live on land and in the sea, and, you know, why don't I have wings on my feet, you know? So I mean, that's why he's I completely get that. And yeah, no, I also thought it was a strong introduction. He's a very interesting character. I guess going down the line, I guess we'll see where what else we get from him. But I mean, obviously, you know, the movie is, it's called Wakanda Forever, but it's still called Black Panther Wakanda Forever. So, you know, in some ways, you know, they were kind of helped in this with the unfortunate scenario they were placed in that the fact that the character of Black Panther is essentially a mantle that can be passed down from person to person. And even in the course of Black Panther, passed between, you know, two people back and forth. So there was the position to get another Black Panther. Now, the marketing seemed to be playing it quite coy about who would be taking on the mantle. I mean, it's pretty clear, I think, I'm not sure if it was to you, but to me, you know, from pretty much from the outset of the film, you know, who was going to be doing it. I mean, it's you know, I don't know if it really counts as spoilers or not, but we can kind of move into sort of the spoiler section. So if you have not seen Black Panther Wakanda Forever yet, go ahead and watch it and come back. Everyone done that? Good. Okay. So obviously, you know, to continue essentially the royal bloodline of the family, Shuri is indeed the one who becomes Black Panther. And this, for a moment, I was really hoping that Okoye might have been able to take it on, but instead she got something, another suit called the Midnight Angel, which looks just a little bit odd, but never mind. I mean, so what did you make of the decision to have Shuri suit up, and what did you make of Letitia Wright's performance in this, essentially being sort of pushed up into the lead of the franchise now?
So it's fine that she's becomes the Black Panther. That makes logical sense. But I'm not saying she's like a bad actor. That's definitely not the case. I mean, you know, I think the problem is like Letitia Wright. You know, if there was problems with her, I'd maybe pick up more on her views on trans people and vaccinations, etc. But the film is, you know, her performance is pretty underwhelming. She sort of, you know, I'm not really pinning all the blame on her, but she sort of lacks the charisma, you know, to kind of carry a nearly 3-hour overstuffed kind of baggy movie. You know, she, for better or worse, gets lost. There's some interesting stuff to be said about grief and dealing with that and depression and sort of responding to that, but this film, with such a ridiculous running time, makes that hard for that kind of character and actress to breathe. And that's why I go back again to like make this like really like a small intimate kind of story about sort of, you have this grief and then this idea that, you know, carrying it forward, what they said, you know, not ripping it all up of like, you've got people that are coming after Wakanda, sort of see them that they're weak. I mean, you always see that with, what is it, like America, every time a sort of new president comes in, they go, right, let's rattle the saber, you know, do something in the seas or whatever, in China, you know, the Middle East, etc., to see what they do. And sort of push her and put her in a position where, you know, she's tackling her grief, dealing with that, while also sort of at the same time, you know, trying to handle this situation and sort of potentially taking on this mantle. That makes for like a potentially really interesting film, and it makes it more intimate, where, you know, this actress, her strengths kind of shine, as opposed to being someone that can carry a movie this size. I mean, very few people can do it in a Marvel movie, very few people can do it on a blockbuster level. So play to your character actor's strengths. You know, a lot of these actors that they have are very good, but like none of them particularly kind of stand out too well. Some of them get little good moments, but it just doesn't work in a film like this, whereas you just make it small, intimate, something really interesting about sort of political kind of powers on sort of that really kind of intimate level. That makes for a really interesting film, and one that allows her to flourish. And otherwise, she just becomes kind of washed away in this movie, that it just inherently is not remotely interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I haven't read any discourse yet about, I'm sure there is some out there, but I have not, thankfully I haven't seen it yet, about the fact that how can Shuri take on Namor? She hasn't had any, you know, we didn't get a 20-minute fight training montage or anything like that. You know, she just takes the herbs and off she goes and stuff like that. But I know, you know, sort of thinking about you, the way you were just describing it and stuff like that, I would, was there ever an opportunity for to kind of do the King's Speech version of Black Panther, where, you know, the King's Speech, you know, the, you know, Colin Firth's brother, played by Ben Mendelsohn, abdicates the throne, and then this guy who was never really expecting to be king is forced into the position of being king, just as it goes into, you know, a world war. And, you know, the could there have been an interesting movie there where she's basically, you know, a reluctant, you know, keeper of the throne, and she's then forced into, you know, how do you deal with that? How do you, because, yeah, I don't think there was enough, there was so much going on in this film, which, again, I completely agree with you, did not need to be 2 hours and 41 minutes long. There was so much going on, but it never spent enough time with her trying to work through those, you know, emotions and the grief and the guilt and stuff like that. You know, working through that while seeing her kingdom crumble and stuff like that, you know, that kind of comes a bit too late in the film, after you've had the standard, well, we've got to go to America for a couple of chase scenes and stuff like that, and bring in people from the MCU that we've seen before and stuff like that. You know, it's just, there's always that, give and take about we want to tell one story, but we've got to, you know, feed the beast essentially, and, you know, bring in stuff to expand the ever continuing MCU and stuff like that. So, yeah, no, I think there could have been potential there. And I think, yeah, that's just right. No, she's okay, but, you know, she wasn't like a standout for me in the first film. I think, you know, Dania Agurea is Okoye, I think, for me, is one of the standouts. She's got, you know, bags of sort of personality and charisma and stuff like that, and she does a lot in the sort of small scenes that she gets. Even Lupita Nyong'o, you know, has some moments as well, and it's just like, yeah, they had a wide range of characters, and it just feels like, you know, given, you know, the relationship to T'Challa with it being a sister and stuff like that, it's like they had to go down that route. But I think there was other people potentially more worthy of the mantle and leading the franchise on, in my opinion. That's just me. So, I mean, you know, in terms of, interested to get your sort of opinion on just a few sort of bits and bobs. We're in the sort of spoiler section, but, you know, what did you make of the nice touch to have the Marvel Studios logo when it came up at the beginning? It was all clips of Chadwick Boseman. That's the only time it's sort of been, I mean, they update it every time with new characters. The last one had sort of Moon Knight in it, but this one was the only other time they've done one particular person, was obviously after Stan Lee's passing. I mean, that was a nice moment. I mean, what did your audience make of that?
My audience, I think we spoke about it recently, how much of the cinema screens are being filled with this. Like, I went to an 11:40 a.m. Saturday morning screening, and there was maybe like 25 people in this, like, 100 screens, like hundreds and hundreds of seats screen. You know, I think people were pretty well spread out. So, you know, there wasn't really much reaction to anything at all in these films. I mean, that's not really out of the question with British cinema audiences in general. But I thought that was a nice touch. See, I just didn't really kind of rate the sort of the beginning and end kind of, you know, tributes to kind of the sort of Black Panther and his passing. I mean, it was fine. You know, it was good, but I just think there was maybe a better way to kind of do it, you know, sort of embrace that sort of the transition. You know, it felt very, very short, the kind of that opening kind of sequence about sort of the, not the quote unquote the celebrations, but sort of the response and reaction and kind of fallout to it. And, you know, I didn't really sit there thinking, oh, where's all the other Avengers? I kind of assumed it might be one of these sorts of funerals where it's like happens really quickly, and then, you know, it's sort of like bury them within a day or something like that. But, you know, there were good little moments, but it, you know, I thought the Marvel logo was probably the best tribute of the lot.
Yeah, no, I'm the same. I was about a 10:40 screening on Friday morning, and yeah, there was probably about a dozen sort of people and stuff like that. I'm sure the sort of evening performances have been busy, and you probably get more of a reaction for the sort of bigger moments. But at that point, you're then kind of, it's that awkward thing now with Marvel thing. You can either go and enjoy it with loads of fans on the evening and get that experience, but by that point you could have been completely spoiled. So you kind of have to try and go as early as possible. And then, I mean, I don't know if it was like for your cinema, but I know I did complain at the end of our last episode about the fact that in Aberdeen there was 59 screenings in one day. And I guess that's the problem. If you have 59 screenings in a day where you can, you know, every half hour you can go and catch it somewhere, you're never really going to get full audiences because everyone's kind of spread out. And so, yeah, it would have been interesting to see it with a big audience. But again, I wanted to avoid spoilers. But in the end, there wasn't really a huge amount to be spoiled, I don't think, apart from, you know, one big return, in inverted commas, when Shuri takes the herb and goes to the ancestral plane, and the person that she meets is her uncle, her cuz, Killmonger. What did you make of the return of Michael B. Jordan? Because it was kind of rumoured, but yeah, obviously there's going to be, you know, how do they bring him back? And I guess they found the easiest narratively acceptable way to bring him back without retconning the fact that he died.
I thought it was going to be Chadwick Boseman for a second.
You did think it was going to be a CGI. They'd said that they were not going to go down that route, but yeah, I guess you never can tell.
Yeah, I didn't think they were going to, but I thought this was
you
the did, one.
Like, your heart was in you. You're like, oh God, they're not gonna.
Yeah, maybe something or another. I thought it was fine and so on. You know, I think he is. You know, I didn't really think the first Black Panther movie was all that great. You know, I know obviously it was nominated for an Oscar, all these great things.
But it's a terrible thing to admit. Thing in that film. I am the same. I was not as blown away by Black Panther as everyone else was. I was very much, I know it was a terrible thing to say at the time, you know, given the reaction to it. But, you know, for me, it just felt like The Lion King set in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. But it was good, but, you know, it wasn't like, I mean, obviously it was a game changer in some ways, but for me, it wasn't like, as a film, it wasn't just all that. But
the best part of it was Michael B. Jordan for me as Killmonger. I mean, I really didn't want to see him go at the end of that film. I wanted to see more that could be done with him. But so it was a welcome return, and you know, there was definitely felt a bit of an edge of tension, and you know, something like, you know, it really put this sort of fire under kind of Shuri to an extent. So yeah, I liked his return. It was welcome. I would have been happy, you know, if there was some sort of higgledy-poke, you know, MacGuffin that could have brought him back for longer. I would have happily bought into that. I mean, it's comic book movies, you can kind of do what you want. So yeah, I was happy to sort of see him in it. I would have just loved more.
Yeah. You know, it's always, I mean, always welcome to see Michael B. Jordan on the big screen. And you know, I really shouldn't be excited for them, but you know, I do enjoy the Creed movies, so excited to see Killmonger versus Kang in Creed 3 in March next year. So then there was the mid-credit scene where Shuri goes to burn her funeral garbs on Haiti, and then says, you know, we are introduced to a young boy who's Lupita Nyong'o's son that she's had with T'Challa. And this is where I started trying to do the mental arithmetic in my head of, I'm pretty sure at some point somebody said that it was 6 years since T'Challa disappeared the first time. So I was assuming that meant the snap. So that was six years since Avengers Infinity War. And then there was 5 years and then everyone came back after the blip. So this would be set, I guess, 6 years after Infinity War. Where that puts it in exactly timeline wise with everything else that's come in phase four, I'm not entirely sure. But you know, we do have T'Challa's son now entering this. There seems to be a theme of sons and daughters arriving in phase four. It happened with the Hulk in She-Hulk TV series. Spoilers if you haven't watched that yet. It seems he had a son on the planet where he's fighting as a gladiator, and we had Thor take on a baby girl in Love and Thunder. So yeah, it seems to be the dad bod phase of the MCU. So I mean, what did you make of this, I wouldn't say a twist, just a sort of plot development, I guess.
I kind of eye rolled it a little bit. I was like, oh, that just felt a bit unnecessary. And you know, from my perspective, I didn't know about the She-Hulk thing. I've really not kept up to date with the TV shows, but you know, I've heard that a lot of people say obviously this is the end of that phase four series, where it was like, you know, it's all about transition and moving from one generation to the other. So I guess it kind of buys in with that, but yeah, it's not really that exciting in my cup of my worldview and all that sort of stuff. It's like, oh, of course there's something like that, you know. Whoa, I can't wait to follow his development for the next 30 years of Marvel movies and see him get his own movie in phase 10 or something.
Oh no, I think they should go full Game of Thrones on it at this point. I was wondering, it's like, sure, he seemed really happy to meet him, but I was thinking, is she now not first in line to the throne? Is it now the kid? And if so, I would love the kid to fight M'Baka for the throne, because I believe that he won by forfeit technically at the end. He really says he wants to fight for the throne, but Shuri's not there. So I'm assuming he is now technically taking the throne of Wakanda. So I would like to see him fight a 6-year-old child. that would be a fun thing. And then no post-credit scene. Normally, the post-credit scene at this point is one, the mid-credit scene normally sets up something within that particular side of the universe. The other scene is either sets up something in the next film or is just a fun sort of little tidbit. But for completely understandable, sat through the whole thing, completely understandable why it just came up with Black Panther will return. Given, you know, the situation, it felt right, the right move. I just should have realised probably. But apparently some ushers have been going into screens and basically telling everyone after the mid-credit scene, there's nothing else. You can go home now. So
yeah, I heard that. So I left quite promptly then. And my bum was grateful for it.
So, I mean, we've sort of talked about it briefly there. I mean, for you, how do you feel Phase 4 has gone for the MCU?
Not very well. I mean, I look back at the run of films, Black Widow, pretty mediocre kind of film. It was watchable. Shang-Chi, I just wasn't, you know, I had one or two good moments. Eternals, well, Eternals was Eternals. I didn't particularly click with sort of Spider-Man No Way Home. Again, it was an interesting film, but it was pretty ugly, and you know, you sort of could see the COVID impact on the production, which sort of undermined it. Doctor Strange was okay. Thor Love and Thunder was one of the worst films I've seen this year, and then Black Panther Wakanda Forever was just not very great at all. It was just one of those things where you just kind of like, you know, I was never really fussed about seeing any of these films kind of opening day and such, like, you know, compared to sort of the previous run. It just sort of feels like, you know, I've said it for a little while, it just feels like obligation cinema.
Yeah, no, I mean, the film wise, you know, I don't think I've rated anything other than Spider-Man No Way Home, which I gave it 5 stars, admittedly. I think on rewatches at home, it's probably maybe dropped to like a 4, but it's, for me, it was still the strongest one. But again, maybe part of that's my connection to Spider-Man as a character and the previous incarnations of him. I think, you know, again, I certainly believe that any sort of enjoyment of Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness was tempered by seeing Everything Everywhere All at Once 2 days before. Yeah, not a fan of Thor and stuff like that. I think in terms of like, but you've also now got sort of like the TV shows which have fed into that. So you got like WandaVision, Falcon and the Winter Soldier, Hawkeye, Loki was a pretty strong entry there. But there's just a lot going on, and like you say, it's a big commitment to watch everything in order to keep up with what's going on. And you know, again, it's like Phase 4 is like, well, that's Phase 4 over. And it's like, oh, because normally, you know, all the phases have been ended with, you know, an Avengers movie or a big team-up movie. So you had like Avengers, and then you had Avengers Age of Ultron, and then you had Avengers Infinity War and Endgame and stuff like that. And Infinity War and Endgame was such a huge moment that I feel like it has struggled going forward with, well, how can we ever get back to something as good as that? And I think, obviously, you know, they're building up to sort of the Kang Dynasty and Secret Wars and stuff like that. But again, will they be able to get something that has that huge cultural moment? I don't know. And, you know, I am sort of, you know, I technically could have gone to see Wakanda Forever at 9:30 in the morning, but I waited until a slightly later show to get a better screening, a better screen size and stuff like that for it. So, you know, I didn't feel the need. And also, I don't know if it's more to do with the cinematic situation at the moment where they're not willing to put on midnight screenings just due to staffing levels and the cost of that. But, you know, there doesn't seem to be that sort of fervor around these films coming out anymore. And I find myself during Phase 4, actually, something which I didn't think I would do after Rise of Skywalker, which is I find myself shifting back more towards Star Wars than Marvel in terms of my Disney output of choice. Obviously, you know, there were Book of Boba Fett was not good, but you know, sort of The Mandalorian, but Andor, I have been loving Andor at the moment.
Yeah, I've heard it's great. I know I've not been up to date with many of the Star Wars shows, but once that gets to the end of its first season, I'm gonna dive
yeah,
in.
No, I think, yeah, I think if you haven't watched it yet, yeah, I think there's like a couple more episodes, and then you'll be able to binge watch the whole thing. But it has really surprised me with how good it's been. Just because it feels like a more sort of grown up Star Wars. It's done by Tony Gilroy, who's done like sort of the Bourne films and Michael Clayton stuff. So it has been grown up. And yeah, Andy Serkis just crushed it in a role in the last couple of episodes. But yeah, I guess, you know, that's for another podcast when we can do a late spoiler special on Andor when you finally get around to watching
it.
Yeah,
I'll definitely watch it. Once it climaxes, I will watch it all as quick as possible, and we'll do an episode on that. I definitely owe you one.
Excellent. So, I mean, that brings us, I mean, I guess the question is, you know, what next for Black Panther and the MCU? I mean, you know, Namor is still out there. There is an uneasy, fragile alliance between the two. I mean, they basically, at the end of the film, they get to the point where they should have got to a lot earlier, which is like saying Wakanda and we're on our own. It's us against like America and stuff like that. It's like, yeah, if you'd figure that out like an hour or so ago, you could have saved everyone a lot of time. But I mean, where would you like to see the franchise going? I mean, there was, I don't know if you saw it, I mean, it was, this is the thing when, you know, I'm like, I didn't think the film needed to be 2.5 hours long, but you know, I was always still looking at like anytime, I think it was Anderson Cooper appeared on the TV to do the news, the little ticker tape. I believe Scott Lang is in the middle of a book tour, which feeds obviously into the next film, which is Ant-Man and the Wasp Quantumania. That's going to be the next one that we're going to get. I think that's February. So, you know, we've got a couple of months off before the next episode of the MCU. But I mean, where would you like to see it go? I think you want to see the smaller, more intimate, self-contained stories as opposed to the need for 3-hour long, over bloated blockbuster fights.
Yeah, go back to the things of like, it's a superhero movie, but it's a political thriller. It's a thing, but it's a heist movie. Do that. Like this was a perfect opportunity to do, I suppose, both a heist and political kind of movie.
They should have done the Crown version of Black Panther. Spencer, but Spencer, surely is Spencer.
Yeah, I would have been interested in that. I mean, the movie's made, what, 380 million worldwide in the past few days? So, you know, it's definitely been a huge success. Exactly. They're going to, you know, they're getting their second series and so on. So, yeah, pretty good news for them and so on. More money for the money pile. But, you know, just do things interesting. Kind of looking ahead to the next pile of movies, I'm not particularly confident they're going to be breaking that kind of mold. It just felt like a huge missed opportunity to do something interesting. Instead, I just got something that kind of bored me for nearly 3 hours, which, you know, for Marvel movies, that's very rare that I'd be bored for that long, but it just felt sort of like, oh, that's disappointing, and that's one of the worst things you can ever say about a film, I think.
Yeah, no, I mean, I felt myself slightly disengaged throughout quite a lot of it. I looked at my watch a couple of times, and yeah, that's not something you want to be doing during a film like this. So I guess, yeah, hoping for a higher quality of output in Phase 5. Having said that, please don't read anything into us if our two white presenters go ahead and then give Ant-Man and the Wasp one many of five stars. It's under 2 hours long. 5 stars, absolutely. It's definitely nothing to do with that. It's just Marvel. It's the bubble is close to bursting.
It's not us. It's you.
The bubble. I feel that the bubble is close to bursting. It's like there's such a pressure to keep this machine going that maybe Kevin Feige stretched a bit too thin. Maybe, yeah, we need a higher quality control level and stuff like that. And yeah, like you say, go back to the individual self-contained stories where it's Marvel film, but it's a different genre and stuff like that, as opposed to just, oh, it's a big CGI blockbuster mess. We need more than that. And we deserve more than that. So there you go.
Yeah, and go see After Sun in cinemas in a few days' time. Instead.
Absolutely, yes. If it is indeed on at your local cinema, and because maybe if it can get maybe Black Panther can drop down to say like 50 screenings a day in order to fit in some extra new films and stuff like that. So yeah, we'll see. But we'll be back in a couple of weeks with some more releases that are not Marvel. We'll try and pick some cooler, smaller, independent films for you to review, to for something to watch if you're fed up with the Marvel machine. So yeah, we'll catch you then. But until then, Wakanda forever.
Join the revolution. Join the Nerd Party.
Welcome to Nerd Party.